Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500. Today's cool fact of the day is that your amygdala, this part of your brain that's very, very old, is the culprit about why you vividly remember all your fearful and embarrassing events. Your amygdala not only releases adrenaline and cortisol during those fearful events, but it also temporarily triggers your enhanced memory functions in your brain. So basically, scaring the crap out of yourself just about guarantees that you're going to remember it. Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's show is also going to talk about brains and guts and a little bit of fear and a few other things like that, because we are talking with an author who's published 2 hit sports books and 3 novels. He's a former police reporter, and you might have read his work on Edmunds.com, but what's really cool is that he's also the most recent author of Wild Cards, a year counting cards with a professional blackjack player, a priest, and a $30,000 bankroll. And our guest name is Philip Reed. Philip, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Dave.
Where the heck do you find a priest and a $30,000 bankroll? Because I got to know.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had one of these lives where a lot of interesting and miscellaneous things have come to me. And I think if your mind is open to these things, they will come into your lives. But it seems like when I want something or something new to happen, things magically appear. And it's been happening my whole life. It doesn't happen on schedule. And it also doesn't happen in the quantities that you would like sometimes. But it does happen. So I was looking, I was actually writing a novel, and I wanted one of the characters to be a card counter, and I had never learned to count cards, although I'd always been kind of fascinated with the concept of an individual beating the casino, you know, the David and Goliath scenario.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine that I met through the golf book, he's a long drive champion, his name is Jacob Bowden. He's a swing speed trainer, teaching people to swing faster, not harder, or building their muscles, but faster. Anyways, he was invited to go to Las Vegas and give a golf lesson to a professional blackjack player. So after that, he came to my house, and he was so pumped up. He said, "You've got to write about a book about this guy." And he brought the MIT Blackjack Manual, kind of a tattered, you know, photocopied thing. And it sat there on my desk for 3 or 4 weeks because I was almost kind of afraid to open it, where it might lead me. Finally, I didn't have anything to read, and I opened it, and I started reading it, and I thought, you know, I could do this. So I called the guy up, and his alias is Bill Pallas, and he, almost all of the blackjack players have aliases, and he we talked, and he wasn't at all what I imagined. You know, I imagined him, he was going to be like some swashbuckling sort of flamboyant guy like Rhett Butler or something, you know. Instead, he was a lot more like a businessman. You know, and he said, "Yeah, I can meet you in Las Vegas." He said, "I usually travel with a priest from my diocese. You know, he plays video poker, I play blackjack. He kicks in some money, and we play out of a bankroll. So if you want to come and meet us, you know, let's do it." So I had to check it out, and that's kind of how the thing got rolling.
Okay, that's actually kind of an amazing story when you think about it. You just ran into the guy, and it's actually bankrolled by a priest, and where is this, like collection plate money? Like, how does this work? That the Lord shall provide, sort of.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, if you have a bigger bankroll, you can play at a higher level, and it makes everything better because you can win faster, you can sustain the downturns better, you can play in the high limits areas. I mean, the priest doesn't have a lot of expenses, so he takes the extra money and invests in Bill and then Bill and me. So we were able to play at a much larger bankroll. But I mean, Bill, at one point he said to me, you know, he was checking out two deck games in the area that he lives. And so he went to the priest and said, you know, I found a good two deck game. And the priest kind of thought it over. You know how priests are very thoughtful. And he said, yeah. Okay, I'm in for a grand. He said, right. Stop by the rector and I'll have the money in an envelope. So so behind the scenes, you know, there's this money changing hands.
I am truly amused. But what you're doing there, just regardless of where you get the money, is you're talking about performing under pressure. And I think all of your books have that element about it. I used to live in Lake Tahoe. I had a place there when I first left Silicon Valley, and I would go and I would count cards at blackjack, and I experimented with different mind-altering substances, and I was never an amazing card counter, but the difference in what you take home, even if you're kind of a crappy one, is just phenomenal. And you $5 hands become $50 hands all of a sudden at the right time, and magically good stuff happens, and the pit boss glares at you. And
oh yeah, well there's that. Then it turns into a whole different game.
Yeah.
It becomes a evading detection. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of people that I talk to and they like to play blackjack and they say, I could never learn to count cards. And I say, well, just look. And when you see a flood of low cards come out, you better raise your bets for the next hand because the high cards are coming and you've got a better chance of winning, you know? So yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, card counters become really obsessed with being absolutely perfect and learning all of the index numbers and everything. But it's not a perfect game. You know, there's the element of luck is still huge. And even when you're perfect, you're only playing at about a 2 to 4% advantage.
I found that I would go into a state of flow where when you're really paying attention to the cards, you sort of just look and you just absorb the information. And I did find that what I ate, and particularly modafinil, one of the smart drugs I'm well known, I took it almost every day for 8 years. I would take an extra dose of it before I'd go count cards. And card counting was effortless on that stuff. And I don't take modafinil on a regular basis anymore. I haven't had it in a very long time because when my biology's dialed in, my brain just works like that anyway. But when my brain wasn't dialed in all the way, it gave me so much more effortless focus. And it's that effortlessness that matters. If you have to struggle to count all, you know, to look at all the cards on the table at once and run a tally in your head, that struggle takes you out of the flow state, and all of a sudden you don't remember what you're supposed to do, and you miss your bet, and you know, you do something that's not going to work.
Yeah, well, there's so much that you really need to pay attention to when you're counting cards, and the cards, you know, are really just the beginning of it, because you need to keep the count, you need to watch your bets, but you need to watch the dealer, then you need to watch the pit boss, you need to find out are they getting calls from surveillance, you know, so When I first started counting cards, it was like I was looking at the table through a telescope, you know, and all I could see was the cards. And, you know, the whole rest of the casino disappeared. But then as I got better and better, my perspective broadened. And I think that this is true probably of all sports. Like, you're playing soccer, you know, you need to know who's around you, who to pass to. You know, you need to see how the ball is spinning. I mean, there's so many things that your brain is processing. And the better you can process it, the better you can play. And I discovered and began experimenting. I mean, I'm a big coffee drinker, so naturally I was drinking coffee to get to the table. But sometimes you can overdo it with coffee.
Yeah.
Because you go through, I think, more peaks and valleys with coffee than modafinil.
It depends on what's in the coffee, too. I was tired of the valleys.
Yes. Yeah, well, I know, and I wish I had had the bulletproof. That would have been a really interesting test to see whether there was that kind of the drop-off. And I would really, because counting cards is like a really, really good test of your ability to process information quickly, reliably, and it's also a good test of your short-term memory.
We found statistically significant improvements on 6 of 7 measures of executive function, testing black mold-free Bulletproof coffee beans against a selection of store-bought beans in a study that I published in the Bulletproof Diet. And these were university-validated style, like 15-minute tests, if I remember right, like twice a day. So we were kind of going deep to figure out, all right, what, there's something really going on here.
Right.
And just better vigilance, right? If you lose that edge for 1 second, you know, you might miss a card. But I imagine some people listening probably don't know much about card counting. We just kind of know it's cheating. And, well, sorry, using fire to stay warm is also cheating against your neighbors who are on fire. So we can talk about that later. But what is card counting? Like just kind of if someone walked up and said, I have no idea what you do, can you walk me through what it is and what it's like?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there is a perception that it's either cheating or illegal. It isn't illegal, but you can get kicked out, because the casinos can read you the Trespass Act, and then when you go back in, you're hit. You're 86th, as a matter of fact. An interesting term that came from the proof of whiskey. Anyways, yeah, well, supposedly if somebody was drinking 100 proof and they were acting out, they'd give them 86, because it was what they served women in the Old West. So people didn't want the perception of being 86th. So anyways, it's a little bit of a misnomer when you say counting cards. People think, wow, how can you count all those cards or memorize a deck? And you're not doing that. Basically, it's a system which has been designed to help you track cards and figure out, are there more high cards or low cards in the deck that you're about to play? So in other words, it's what they call a dependent sequence of events. So you've seen half the deck, and let's say there were a lot of little cards in half the deck. The second half of the deck is going to be hot, because the 10 cards and the aces are what's good for the player. Because you can be literally dealt a 20 or a blackjack, whereas the dealer, if the dealer gets a 14, he still has to hit and then bust. So high cards are good for the player, low cards are good for the dealer. And once you know that, and you know the way that the deck or the composition of the deck which is coming, you can then know when to raise your bets. I mean, it's really pretty simple, because it's like telling you when to raise your bets. So you want maximum money when the deck is hot, minimum when the deck is cold. And that's it. I mean, it's really pretty simple.
That was my understanding. Like, I didn't study the science in advanced levels, but you know, you can read about it on Wikipedia.
Sure.
There's tutorials. There's games you can play on your iPhone that will show you exactly how to count. And you don't have, there's various systems. Some are more complex than others. But when you do a relatively
right.
simple one, it still tilts the odds in your favor. And it was...
That's right.
I don't know how many nights I played when I lived in Tahoe. I didn't become obsessed with it. But you could go down and you could pretty reliably, at least at the... I'm like, I go there, I'm willing to lose $200. Like, and that is entertainment money. So it's okay if you lose it. Like, you would have spent that on a show and dinner anyway. So you go, you spend $200. And surprisingly often, I'd walk away with $1,000 at the end of the night. Which is kind of cool, right?
You know, it's so amazing to win money. It's almost like you've created money out of nothing, you know?
Yeah.
But the real kicker is if you use your brain to win money, then you feel smart, you know?
That's good for the ego, right?
Yeah, yeah. And part of the book that I wrote was about, wanting to feel smart. Now, I've been reasonably successful as a writer and, you know, other things, but I never really felt smart. And my father had a PhD. He was a chemist and an inventor. He worked for MIT. Other people in my family, you know, they just were really quick in a way that I didn't feel that I was. So when I turned 59, I was thinking, I would need something to keep my brain sharp and everything. So this opportunity came along and I thought, well, here it is. I need to prove that I can do it. And I think a lot of what I learned is that so much of that being smart is really preparation. It's, you know, hard work, it's study and all of those things. And then when you need it, the ability to perform under pressure. And that became a fascinating part of this book, too, because I think really almost anybody could get used to doing anything if they did it enough and if they gradually ramped it up. Like, I know you've done a lot of public speaking and so on. I mean, did you have a learning curve about being in front of the camera and things like that?
There's a total learning curve. In fact, people wouldn't believe it, but I didn't have any idea how to interact in a crowd. I had all the signs of Asperger's. I wasn't formally diagnosed, but I was diagnosed with ADD. And I had all these behavioral things. So in my very early 20s, when I first moved to Silicon Valley, every Thursday night, I would hang out at this business networking thing and just like watch what people would do and then try and copy it until I could figure out like how you play the game. And the first time I went on stage, I knocked him dead, but I was completely panicked. So I was in this complete like flow state. I have no idea what I said, but everyone clapped at the end and like they laughed and it was good. And that was how I kind of launched it. But I taught for 5 years, four nights a week, to get good at public speaking because I wasn't good at it. Like, I put in the time. So, yeah, the learning curve was actually pretty steep for me, I think.
Yeah, well, mine came about because I wrote a number of novels. And maybe 15 years ago, they still did book signings. And so I would go and speak to small groups. And then I spoke to larger groups and larger and larger. Then when I started working for Edmunds.com, they occasionally would put me on like national television, you know, and you'd sit there in a dark room and they'd say, okay, this is live. So, you know, you can't screw up. And luckily I had the background where I knew that if I opened my mouth, something reasonably coherent would come out, but I never knew what it was going to be, you know? And that's actually, if you learn to trust yourself, it can be pretty exciting.
It's really unnerving. The first time I did that, I was for CNN. And they said, oh, can you be on TV to talk about smart drugs? I said, sure. I believe these can help so many people. I'm happy to do it. And I flew to San Francisco and I'm expecting like a studio. And you walk in, it's like I'm talking to like the Terminator. There's just like a room. There's no one in there. It's like a red light and a lens. And it's like, and there's a guy behind the glass. And to be on live TV talking to a wall, I mean, I knocked him dead, right? But I did a bunch of like meditative stuff ahead of time because it's very unnerving. So you pulled that off as well.
Yeah. Now, you know, it sounds like we've taken kind of a similar journey because, you know, almost my adult life, I've been researching ways not to get nervous or to be able to handle nervousness.
Yeah.
And people will say, I'm no good at public speaking. And I'll say, well, you get nervous, right? Yeah, I get so nervous. I say, well, I do too. And, you know, and here's what I did in the early days when I was still a runner. Of course, if you run far enough, then you get sort of that endorphin.
Right.
And that would really smooth things out because you get in front of a crowd and you just all of a sudden get this like wave of nervousness that almost kind of overcomes you and overwhelms you. But if you can get past that, then you get to this really exciting place too. And that's where a lot of people never get to, which is a shame because it'd be nice to hear what they had to say.
Yeah, it's a practice thing. And now like I know that I'm serving the audience and I'm there for them and I love going on stage and there's no fear at all, but it was a multi-year thing where like you just have to learn. And I'm guessing I never got there with card count. Like I was never nervous about it. I'm like, I don't do this for a living. Like I have no fear of being kicked out of the casino. If they kick me out, I just don't care. Right.
Yeah.
So they never did. And I don't know, maybe it's because I wasn't that good, but I do know that when my bets would go from, you know, the 5 to 50 or 100, or I'd, you know, bet four things on the table at once, like the real obvious signs that this guy's counting cards, I would just act a little drunk the next one.
Yeah.
And maybe, well, they believe me.
Card counters always need a good cover. And, you know, you're in a casino, you know, the drunkenness is a good cover. Well, what happened was, you know, I started traveling with Bill, and, you know, he's a very high-level player. So first time we went to Las Vegas, I barely played at a casino at all. And he said, you know, bring $2,000. And I was like, that's a lot of money for me. First time I sat down, I played, I lost $700. And it was like somebody slugged me in the stomach, you know. But what I didn't realize was that that's the price of admission. You know, you're going to take some hits, but you're also going to get some really big wins. I mean, a couple of times I sat down and I won $1,500 in 5 minutes. So, you know, you have to understand the process. And it took me a while to, I mean, my hands would shake. I could feel my hands sweating. My mouth would get really dry. I mean, all the signs of acute nervousness. And it was the nervousness of being in an intimidating atmosphere and also the threat of, you know, really losing large sums of money in a very short amount of time.
So how much did you end up making your first year when you started counting cards?
Yeah, well, Bill and I and the priest, of course, traveled and we went to Las Vegas, Biloxi, Tunica. I took a cross-country trip in an old car and I played in every casino I could find. So at the end of the... Yeah, it was a great, great trip. And at the end of the year, I had $6,100. So, you know, I think that that's good proof that the system works.
So you had $6,100 after paying for gas?
Yeah, well, it was, well, that's another story. But yeah, it was a project that I did for Edmunds. So.
Oh, okay, cool. So you were already cruising around anyway. Okay,
yeah.
So it was a road trip and you were having a good time and you managed to work this in. So, okay, so $6,000 is not shabby at all. And you got to have fun doing it too, right?
I had a lot of fun, you know. And one of the things too is that the risk is part of it. It's exciting. I mean, I'd take a beating, then I'd go home and I'd say, I'm never going to do this again. 2 or 3 days later, it's like, hey, when's the next trip?
Yeah, risk is the spice of life, right? Every time I see these ridiculous things, you know, safety is job one.
Yeah.
It's like that's a Ford slogan. It's like, actually, no, getting my ass there is job one. Safety is not job one, because if safety was job one, we shouldn't be driving now, should we?
And
I'm starting to get a little upset with that on like the World Anti-Doping Leagues. Well, it's all about safety. I'm like, you allow people to run into each other head on and cause concussions in 96% of them, but they can't use testosterone when they're getting old to stay young. Like, how messed up is that?
Well, it's an incredible double standard on so many levels. But some of that is changing, I hope, but it changes very slowly. It's terrible. But yeah, the risk was, well, I mean, one of the discoveries, it sort of came by talking to the priest, you know, and I said, you know, I think all of these casinos are built by greed. And he said, no, it's not greed. He said, it's risk, because it's risk that puts us in the moment.
Yeah.
He said, you know, and that's why we watch sports. You know, you hear the crack of the bat, and is it going to be a foul ball or is it going to be a grand slam? You know, and for that moment, you're completely suspended.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're playing cards, you're not going to be thinking about where did I park the car or, you know, you're completely in the moment. And I guess that becomes pretty addictive. You know, that's probably part of the compulsiveness of a lot of these things, because they say like base jumpers and, you know, those high-risk ultra sports people. In fact, I think, did you recommend the book of The Return of Superman?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, Stephen and I have hung out many times. He was a keynote at the second annual Bulletproof Conference.
Yeah. I read that after we talked, because I've been meditating, you know, and you're always trying to get to that place where you're really in the moment. And the revelation of that book was that when you do these extremely dangerous things, it puts you into the moment. You have no choice, you know.
I have a 26-foot-tall tree where we needed to take the tree out. So we cut off the top of the tree. It's about this big in diameter. For people who are driving, it's about, I don't know, 18 inches, 24 inches in diameter. And I put a ladder on the side of it so I can climb up the tree and stand on the top of the tree to meditate, the flagpole meditation. Why do they do that? You do that because it puts you in the, like, if you fall down, you'll die. So then you're really in the moment when you're meditating. And it also makes you put your visual field, you can't focus on a spot right next to your feet. You have to focus on a spot a mile away. And when you do that, it expands your sense of self very dramatically. I use a safety harness, so it's just going to hurt if I fall.
But it's
the same thing. You've got to have something that's going to make you do it.
Yeah. And I think of myself as being a risk-averse person, but I think this book kind of changed that, because there's so many people that said, oh, that sounds cool, maybe I'll try it. And then they look into it and it's like, there's no way I'm doing what you did. You know, I mean, I don't think of myself as a hero or anything. I just had a unique opportunity and kind of wrote it. you know, by because I had a lot to learn from Bill. There was an opportunity to kind of try to peer into his head, you know, because I was struggling to learn card counting and all of that. And I wanted to know, why is he so good at it? I mean, the perception, of course, the Hollywood perception is, oh, if you're a genius, you can count cards.
It doesn't require genius at all. It's like adding ones and twos. Like, it's really not hard.
No.
But it's hard to pay that much attention. But it's not an intelligence thing, right?
No, not at all. I mean, first of all, people say, well, I'm not good at math. Well, the math has been done for you, you know? I mean, when computers came in, what they did was they would just take every card combination that you could get and they put it into an IBM computer at the time and played a million hands. And then they said, you know, hitting 16 against a dealer's 10 wins, you know, 53% of the time. So, you know, that was how it was done, yeah. So, you know, do the mathematically correct thing. But so you don't have to be using formulas or, you know, but you do need to have good short-term memory. And you need to be able to hold the count in your head despite the fact people are talking to you, you know, new people are coming in and out of the table, you know, all of the distractions of the casino. And that's what becomes difficult.
I've done a lot of work with software on training working memory. And in most people, you can double working memory in about 20 days. But the training is so uncomfortable because of the sense of failure that's just is all over you. I mean, I've had billionaires just fail at doing this, like clients, where they're like, I'm not doing that, but I'll have like the 22-year-old who works for me because I can make him do it because like I pay him to do it. And like, it does work, but I'm not going to do it because it's so stressful. And what you're doing, though, is you're putting yourself in a situation where there's high-stakes learning, and not high-dollar stakes, but for the brain, the money, survival, they're all tied together at the lowest levels. So you're basically telling your brain, like, there's survival, there's big opportunity, there's that element of risk, which is a huge reason to grow new neurons. And then you're putting yourself in an environment where ability to pay attention becomes of paramount importance when there's a big threat. And I think that causes more rapid neurogenesis, where you actually are going to grow first new synapses and then myelinate the synapses, and then it should become effortless.
Right.
Is that your perspective? I mean, I'm making this up, but that's my experience of the world.
Well, I think the brain is a tool that is waiting for you to tell it what you need, and then it will go in that direction. And I think the brain is also a mechanism for survival. So what you were just describing was basically sensing danger and building a system to cope with that danger. And I think that the brain is really good at that if you let it do it its thing. I think it knows more than the conscious mind does. And I found that, you know, under pressure, there was a time when I wasn't really performing, and then I got better under pressure. And that becomes interesting. And I think that the world's top-level athletes know about that, you know, that it's, and they need it. You know, first of all, the people resist the pressure, then they come to almost really feed on it. You know, it's like, who wants the ball at the end of the game? You know, it's the person that thrives on pressure.
When you were in school, did you wait till the last minute to study or write a paper?
I just did that. I turned in a story and it was right at the end, and my editor said, Well, you know, that's what I expect from you. I'm apparently what they call a cliffhanger. I don't wait. I don't start on it until I have to, and then I do it right at the last minute. And I have a strong belief, according to a survey I took, that I perform best under pressure. And it kind of helped to know this. Now, the interesting thing was my wife took the survey. She's complete opposite. You know, starts early, studies hard, all those things never really, you know, worked all that well for me. You know, anyways, all of our brains are different. I mean, that was what was so much fun about writing this book, was it was like, you know, I learn in a very different way, but I think I finally figured that out, and I made it work. You know, and I wish I'd found it out earlier, but that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Everyone's brain is different, and finding what works for you is so important. And for you, card counting seemed to work, maybe because you're one of those last minute people. What did it do for your brain health? Like, did you see changes in your cognitive abilities when you became good at counting cards?
Yeah, well, I started the book when I was 59. I'm 63 now. It was at a time when a lot of my peers were saying things like, oh, my gosh, I forgot that name. I guess I'm getting old, you know, buying into the whole thing. And I think that's one of the things that made me write the book.
Don't buy into that. That's a bunch of crap. Like their brains are failing because they need the right nutrition, the right anti-aging therapies. Like, there's no excuse for that at any age.
I think you're absolutely right, you know, but there's a kind of a collective aging process, you know, where you look at your peers and, you know, you think, oh, yeah, we're all, you know, get together and they all complain together. But I think, you know, the interesting thing, Dave, and I'm sure this is fascinating for you, but you have your good days when you're really on top of things and everything's right on the tip of your tongue, you know, and then other days where it just doesn't seem to be happening. And, you know, is it what you ate last night? Is it how you slept? You know, it's probably a combination of a lot of those things. So this was a good examination of really optimizing performance in a way that was impossible to escape. It wasn't like giving a speech and saying, oh, that was pretty good afterwards. I mean, you go away from the table and you either won or you're lost, you know. And that's a pretty clear division right there. And also having something at stake all of the time. Now, what happened was it was a great opportunity because I was 59 and I took a sabbatical from my job and I had 4 months. So I spent a lot of that time learning card counting, but I was also studying Spanish. And I went down to South America and I played blackjack down there. One of the things, too, that was fascinating about this book, I mentioned my father's a PhD, he's a scientist. I have a son who's a musician, and he's extremely good with languages, you know, so there's that kind of commonality of language and music, and also, you know, he's very good with, I taught him how to count cards. He doesn't have a bankroll, so, I mean, that's a big stopper right there, but, I mean, he clicked with all of those things right away, but I kept saying to myself, his brain is so different than mine, he got this from his mother. That was kind of the, it was humbling. But I think that, you know, if you learn to work with your brain, then you can, the problem is that the school system is so rigid in the way that it teaches and rewards. Because the reward part of it is so big, because the message I got from school was, you know, you didn't do well, you're not going to do well in life. So, you know, didn't get good grades.
The school system does weird things for sure. I remember way back in the day, like about 20 or so years ago, I was the only student in university who had a laptop. And it was $5,000 that I didn't have. I put it on 3 different credit cards and lugged this 12-pound behemoth to class because I could take notes on it. And my notes were actually legible and more coherent. And one semester, and I wasn't a great student at all, and according to my GPA. So one semester, I'm like, I really need to get done with this college thing, so I'm just going to do 2 semesters in 1. So I doubled my course load, that thing working under pressure, right?
Yeah,
I used the laptop, and what I found is if I played Free Cell, like the dumb little solitaire game, that one that comes with Windows 95, Windows 3.1, I guess, back then, and if I would play that during class, and then I would switch over, take notes, and switch back, that I got a 3.9, the highest GPA I ever got. Mm. And it was because my brain never shut down. And of course, everyone in class was really offended. How dare you play? It's disrespectful. And I would just look at them and be like, how dare you look at my screen? It's private. Right? And I would just do this. And pretty soon, the other like really smart guy in the class would sit next to me and we would collaboratively play. And both of us were like acing everything because I think our brains were the kind of brains that were like, is this all? Like, so it just kept the brain busy so that it would keep paying attention. And it was like the information would just flow in. Okay, that worked for me. But the person next to me probably would have just gone insane if they tried to do that. So school there, I wasn't supposed to be doing that, but I didn't care. I just did it. And I was lucky I found it. But for everyone like me, there's probably 20 other cognitive styles that are completely like crushed by the time you get into university, if you even can afford to go.
That's true. I mean, I think that the only real gift that I had was self-confidence. So people would, you know, people would say, you can't be a writer, you know, and I would keep trying anyways. And eventually, I mean, that trumped all of the other stuff because I found a way to do the things that I wanted to do. But you're right. I mean, people do get crushed. They listen to their professors, and their professor said, like, for example, when I was just about to graduate from college, one professor came to me and he said, you know, you're a pretty good writer. You should maybe make a living doing this stuff. And another professor came to me at the same time and said, writing is terrible. You know, if you really want to graduate. So it's like, here's two experts. One's telling me I'm good enough to make a living at it. You know, so I guess I paid attention to the one that liked my writing. But maybe there's something inside all of us that kind of guides us and gives us a sort of a sense of what you're good at. I mean, like, there's the word destiny, which is really a big word, you know, and tied to so many things. But I really wanted to be a writer. I really loved exploring new things. And I think as a journalist, my curiosity became probably one of my best qualities and tools.
So you applied your curiosity to counting cards, but you also hooked up with a mentor, which is one of the more powerful ways to learn something quickly.
Yes.
What could Bill Pallas, your card counting mentor, like, what could he do? Like what were his mental abilities? Just paint me a picture of that.
Yeah. Well, I have three sports books, as you mentioned, and they all have to do with mentors, learning something from a mentor. And well, first of all, I have to tell you that I probably wouldn't have stuck with this whole process had it not been for Bill. Because he was there when I got the big losses, saying, you know, you made the right plays, but, you know, the cards weren't there or whatever. And he also perceived at times situations that I was not processing correctly and saying, we need to find a way to kind of get through this hurdle. Like, for example, when the cards come out, you shouldn't count them all until they're on the table. So he gave me a way to literally say, look here first, here, here, and then here. And don't do it until they're out there. Because a big part of card counting is, since you're counting high and low cards, if you see one high card and one low card, they just cancel each other. So they don't change the count. So you can look at a table and just kind of almost like in a second. Like Bill says, he just can scan an entire table of cards and knows instantly what the count is. He doesn't even know what he's doing at this time.
Because it's automated.
That's it.
Okay.
It's so, he's been playing for about 15 years. And yeah, and he played also for the MIT team. He played, you know, they would go into a casino with, you know, the teams. They'd give $5,000 to each of the counters. And then the big players had $15,000. And they would come down and make $5,000 bets. So you better be accurate with the count if you're putting that kind of money down.
Well, one of the guys on my team at Wharton, my business school, was a roommate of one of the MIT team guys the book was written about, the real famous book about,
right.
You know, weird
bringing
behavior.
Bringing down the house, yeah.
Yeah, bringing down the house. And I first heard about card counting actually when I was a kid, because my father was a backup player for the Berkeley card counting team back when it was first invented. And his professor, who was one of the founders, I don't remember the guy's name, actually flew the team out to Monaco and broke the house. Or Morocco, Monaco, God, I forget. One of the M countries. Or M
it's Monaco.
Monaco, yeah. And broke one of the houses.
Yep.
And the final line, and my dad, I just remember the story being told over the dinner table with my dad. The final line was, you know, one of the card counting teams, the professor, had a 20. And there was one card left. And he said, hit. And the dealer was like, I won't hit that. And finally, he looked at the dealer and says, give me the effing ace. And turns it over, and it was an ace. And, you know, that was the final thing. But, like, that, this really happened. And it's really high stakes and just fascinating stuff. And I think it's cool that you wrote a book about it, because no one thinks about the difference between crossword puzzles and Sudoku and card counting. And I tell you, what you did for your brain absolutely kicked ass over sitting around and playing crossword all the time. Like because it came with some sort of risk. And that is what makes the brain adapt. If you're just sitting there, well, the risk is I might run out of, I have to sharpen my pencil. It's too milquetoast. It doesn't work.
Right. It doesn't keep you focused. I mean, it kind of goes back to that thing we were talking about earlier, is if you perceive danger, you're going to be really focused. And you're going to push into new territories, too. That's the other thing, is that you can't artificially invent these things. You almost have to go into a real test to find out what's there, to find out what's in your own mind. You can't just imagine it or whatever. I mean, it's got to all be there. And, there was a lot of that. But the early days of card counting are very interesting. It pretty much started on the West Coast. And there was a guy named Al Francesca who started some of the first teams. And Kenny Houston was like the head of the West Coast Stock Exchange. And he was a young guy, really brilliant and everything. And he ran into Al Francesca, and Al Francesca told him about card counting. And all of a sudden, he like left his wife and kids. He started putting on disguises, wow, traveling all over the world. He became one of the most sort of feared card counters. He organized lots of teams. And then he died at a pretty young age in Europe. A lot of people, actually Bill thinks he may have been poisoned because wow, he made a lot of enemies. But yeah, I mean, that would be interesting to talk to your dad about that.
I'm pretty darn sure the guy's name was Al Francesca. That struck a chord. But yeah, I'll ask my dad next time I see him, because it's one of those things, like, he hasn't talked about it probably in 15 years, but you made me think of it. And it's really neat, because part of this is about gaming the system. And a lot of biohacking is also that way. Like the body's set up a certain way to respond to a set of rules in the environment. You're like, oh, wait, like when you look at patterns, like you do when you're looking at blackjack, you realize that there are patterns that aren't really necessarily obvious. But if you take advantage of those, you can have more control over outcomes than you otherwise would. What appeared to be random wasn't, and it was something you could influence. And like, that's just fun, at least the way I'm wired.
Yeah. Actually, I noticed that the pattern thing is really interesting, because if you play blackjack long enough, you begin to sort of sense those patterns coming together, and it pleases the brain. The brain kind of reacts to it sort of like, this is a system, I see it working, and the outcome now is no longer random.
It's huge dopamine that comes from it. I remember you just described earlier how you can look at a whole table full of cards and just know the count is three, because all the threes and kings cancel each other out, and suddenly you just knew. And when you know and it's effortless, you get this feeling of bliss. And then when you realize, oh, the count's really good, like I'm putting it all on the line on the next hand, and then it works, it's way different than going up and putting it all on black and then winning and walking around being really happy. There's a feeling of control that is so cool.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the first things that Bill said to me is, he said, you know, I'm not a gambler. He said, I'm an investor. Card counters call themselves advantage players because they have a mathematical advantage. And it's so weird that here's the casino. Everybody's gambling, having a good time. But there's one little group of people that come in and they actually have an advantage against the house. That kind of fascinated me. And it was like what you were saying. It was like a hack. It was like, this is a system that exists and you can do it. Takes a long time to learn it, but you can do it and you can win money consistently.
Now, Al and his guys had teams where it were like, at least this is as my dad describes it, and I'm pretty sure I've read a book or two about this over the years. But, you know, one of the students or members of the team would play just to get the count, and then they'd scratch their nose, and then the college professor guy would pretend like he was just shitty drunk, stumble over to the table, slap down, you know, $5,000, get the hit, and then, you know, walk away and order some more booze. To keep the suspicion away. And he'd do this table after table. Was this the sort of thing, I mean, were you guys tag teaming or were you working independently? Or are you not allowed to say?
Well, no. Well, Bill was what they call a big player. So he was the guy that would come in and put down the big bets.
Okay.
And yeah, so they had a team and they would train the students to be counters. And then he was the one who would make the big bets. Because to be clear, you have to make it look like it's luck.
Yeah.
Like if you suddenly start jumping your bets, you know, you said this earlier, but if you suddenly go from $5 to $50 or $100, you know, pretty soon they know.
Oh yeah, they were watching me in Tahoe. Yeah. I absolutely knew it, but I never won that much money. It was, you know, $1,000, $2,000, and then I would leave because I lived there. Like it wasn't like I couldn't do it every night if I wanted to. So
yeah, okay. Right. And that's the way that you really need to do it. I mean, no, but so Bill and I, we didn't really do that. I mean, we pooled our money with the priest and Bill, and then we played out of a larger bankroll. But there are other ways that, like, there are husband and wife teams. I read about a couple that goes to Atlantic City, and the husband sits there and plays and chats and drinks, but his wife stands behind him and squeezes his shoulder, giving him the count. So she's completely focused. There are other ways, too. Like, there were two guys, they stand on opposite sides of the pit playing, and then when the count gets high, they switch positions and make big bets in the other guys, at the other guy's table. So there's been all sorts of little ways, you know, to game the system and make money. But the problem is you got to keep moving. you got to avoid detection because facial recognition software is getting better all the time. They're beginning to count cards, you know, upstairs. So if they think you're counting, they call surveillance. Surveillance puts the cards into a computer, counts, and if you raise your bets when the count is high, your history.
Yeah, Wired had a good article about this a few years ago about the technology to counter the card counters. And if for people listening, if you're into this kind of like systems and how systems evolve, it's a fascinating example where you would never imagine the amount of tech that's deployed to figure out when someone's doing this, so that they're looking at all sorts of very fine details and sharing information. And what they're doing actually makes like Interpol or the IRS or any of the government bodies actually look sort of lame. Yeah. Like it is really advanced. That's the constant arms race that we have when we get control of a system. The system oftentimes fights back.
Absolutely. And, you know, Bill says all the time that the fear of card counters on the behalf of the casinos is really unjustified because a lot of people try to do it and they can't win. What they really need to be afraid of is the teams that are really good and come in and can take quite a bit of money. But, most people, you know, what we did was always just kind of a hit and run. So we would, because it takes about 20 minutes for them to be suspicious. It takes a few more minutes for them to call surveillance and all of that. So you can make a pretty good living, you know, playing half hour, 20 minute sessions and just going from casino to casino. So like if we go to Las Vegas, we'll just kind of do a rotation and we text each other after we've played, you know, how much they won, how much they lost, or what the conditions are like and all that. So it's a whole lot of fun, particularly when the priest is around, you know.
So if I was going to go to...
He's a big Shania Twain fan, so...
Nice.
We had to go to the show, yeah.
Then you have an excuse to go, right? You go to the concert and you paid for your tickets and everybody wins, right?
Yeah, right.
So if I was going to go to Vegas tomorrow to play blackjack, what are five things you could teach me now that would help me win? And obviously everyone listening, you know, they're all interested too.
Well, first of all, you can write down a couple of things on a cocktail napkin and take it to the table with you. They don't care. You can get, those basic strategy cards.
Yeah. They'll give you one if you ask them.
Yeah. They'll give you, you consult. I mean, you can ask the dealer if you should hit or stand, but sometimes they don't even know. You know. So if you were going to Las Vegas, I would say download an app and play on your phone because you see people playing solitaire all the time and they're never going to make any money doing that. So why not learn to play blackjack? Because the interesting thing about blackjack is you can get about 80% of the way with about five simple rules. So, you know, get the app, play, you know, if your trip's a week or so away, you'll be in pretty good shape by the time you get there because it's not hard to get almost to even with the casino just using basic strategy.
Right.
So if you know perfect basic strategy, you're at about 0.25% disadvantage. So, you know, that would be one of the first things I'd recommend. And then the other rules are, you know, you always split eights and aces. That's one of the really big ones. Then, you know, basically you hit until you get 17 if the dealer has 7 or above.
Yeah.
You know, so
it's real basic stuff, right?
Yeah. But, you know, you still see people like, well, what should I do? Hit or stand, you know. But then beyond that, there's a lot of things that you can double and split, which will make you a ton of money. Because basically the way the game is constructed, you'll only win about 47% of the hands. So you're trying to overcome this deficit of about 3%. And you do that by doubling and splitting and raising your bets. And once you begin to do that, you can do well. You can play even, you can get some nice wins and a whole bunch of comps if you like going there. I mean, if you like going to Vegas anyways and you like to sit at a table and play, why not learn a few simple rules? Another one that we highly recommend is to try to play alone. So play in the mornings because the tables will be empty and the stakes will be lower. So, you know, you don't want to play with a bunch of people. Most people play with a lot of people because they want to, you know, quote unquote, lose slowly. Because they think they're going to lose. So playing head up against a dealer is a good way to go. I'm not sure that was five, but that was a few good tips.
It was still some good tips.
Yeah.
What performance-enhancing substances did you find worked best if you were going to do card counting?
So number one, coffee. Coffee, good night's sleep, meditation. That's not a substance, but meditation was really good. to kind of calm you down and increase the speed of processing. But halfway through the book, I got tested for ADD, so I used Adderall. And Adderall speeds up your cognition, so you just do things faster, and that's useful. I don't particularly like Adderall.
I
like modafinil better, but I didn't use that. I kind of discovered that late in the process. But I'd love to try some of the bulletproof substances, too.
Well, you've already got them, and there's two professional poker players. Actually, come to think of it, there's three professional poker players who use bulletproof extensively. I don't know any professional blackjack players who use it, but Nam is a world champion. Nam Le, a world champion poker player, like World Series of Poker, and just completely changed the way he played. And now when he backs someone, he requires that they use bulletproof coffee because you just have more energy for this, which is really kind of funny. And okay, so I know that you're going to like Brain Octane and Bulletproof Coffee. You said modafinil, you discovered late in the process. Adderall, kind of, but you don't like it. What about food?
I use the normal ginkgo biloba.
Ginkgo.
And ginseng to some degree.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll make sure we send you some choline force, which I talked about at the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. Having more acetylcholine for a lot of brains can really help on this kind of thing as well. Just this is one of the stimulatory, like focusing neurotransmitters that's it's particularly important for this kind of stuff. What I found too was that depending on your tolerance for things, if I did it now, I would have bulletproof coffee. But back when I was doing a lot of this stuff, I had figured out some aspects of the diet, but not all of them. And in the very early days, one of the things that gets you is you're always like drinking either alcohol or sugar. And you're eating junk food, and they actually ply you with that stuff on purpose because they know that it makes you make bad decisions.
Yes.
But if you're there at the table and you're on a winning streak and you're not going to eat like a bulletproof bar, which is what I would do now, what you can do, though, is you can actually tell them that you want an orange Julius with a raw egg in it. Mm. And they'll still do that. And God knows what they actually put in the orange Julius. It's probably skim milk powder, a bunch of crap. But in the old days, it was basically raw egg blended with milk and orange juice. Mm-hmm. And it's the closest thing you can get to like something with protein and fat at a casino if you didn't have anything with you and you're not going to leave the table.
Okay.
I would not recommend that as a health food. It's not a bulletproof food. It's just better than, let me have two shots of tequila or a martini or something. Like that's going to take you out of your game. I'm assuming you didn't drink. Did you drink beer when you did this? Or?
Well, it helps if you do order a beer.
But do you drink it or just order it?
Just order it.
Okay.
so that it looks like you're a happy-go-lucky. What Bill would do is get a martini, pour it out in the restroom, and refill it with water, but keep the olive. So, it looked like he was drinking, vodka or gin. So, it's a good idea because the profile of the card counter, of course, you're drinking Perrier, you're not tipping the dealer, all those things. You want to get away from all of that.
Okay, so you want to blend in and look a little drunk.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's super cool. If someone tomorrow said, "Hey, I want to learn how to count cards," what would you tell them? I'm a total virgin. What do I do?
Yeah, I think allow yourself enough time to really do it for real. Don't think you're going to do it overnight. Find a good system and a place you can practice at small stakes. And then I would say, don't be too discouraged by early losses and don't be too encouraged by early wins, because both of those you'll find are a little misleading. And give yourself time to do it and make sure that you know that your processing speed, when you're in your living room at your kitchen table, they talk about kitchen table blackjack players, is going to be very different than casino conditions. It's a little bit like shooting free throws alone in a gym and then having the game on the line. So nice. Allow time to do that and understand the process. Then beyond that, find a good system. There are probably 25 different card counting systems. Some of them are very simple and some are very challenging. And it will be an interesting journey into your own brain and how you work.
I love the idea of counting cards as a way of self-discovery. And my experience was certainly that, and I was nowhere near at your level, but there's a lot to be learned about your cognitive style and how you perform under pressure in this scenario. So it's great fun and it's legal and it's not taken away from anyone except the house if you're lucky, and they deserve it.
They do. Black-hearted corporations.
Now, there's one more question for you, and one that's been on every episode of Bulletproof Radio. If someone came to you tomorrow, and instead of asking about counting cards, they just said, look, I want to be better at every single thing I do in life. Like, I want to be a better human being.
Yeah.
What are the three most important pieces of advice you'd offer them?
Well, I think understand that you're nowhere near as limited as you think you are. And the second thing is learn how to face your fears. I think I got this idea that if you're afraid of something, you should go straight at it. Because if you do, there's something that will go along with you to give you the strength to succeed. And then the third thing is to understand that really anything worth doing will take time to accomplish. So those are the, you know, a few of the things that I've learned in my less than perfect life.
Thank you for sharing those. Philip Reed, author of Wild Cards, where can people find more about your books?
Well, you can get a Kindle version of it. It's also out in hardcover, and right now it's in Barnes & Noble and an actual bookstore still, which is very exciting.
Oh, that makes it easy to pick it up. So the title of the book is Wild Cards, and the full title, I have to scroll up here to remember the whole title because it's really long. A Year Counting Cards with a Professional Blackjack Player, a Priest, and a $30,000 Bankroll. Thanks again for being on Bulletproof Radio.
I had a great time. Thank you, Dave.
If you enjoyed today's episode, I'd love it if you went out to iTunes and you took just a minute to leave a review. You can also find Bulletproof Radio with full transcripts, interactive transcripts, where you can take just little bits of this and share it with your friends. And you can find those on bulletproofexec.com. And you can head on over to Podcast One, which is the podcast network that distributes Bulletproof Radio. And there's a bunch of other good stuff there as well. So I appreciate your support. I appreciate you listening, and have an awesome day. Make it more awesome with Choline Force. If you like this episode, try that stuff, see what you can do for your brain.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.